Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
We're delighted tonight to have Timothy Shaffert here with his new novel, The Swan Gondola, an amazing and magical story about the 1898 Omaha World's Fair. Timothy Shaffert has written four previous novels, including The Phantom Limbs of the Rollo Sisters in 2002, The Singing and Dancing Daughters of God in 2005, Devils in the Sugar Shop in 2007, and The Coffins of Little Hope in 2011. All of his work has been enthusiastically received, and Swan Gondola was chosen as this spring's VIB book by the Tattered Cover Bookstore. VIB is Very Impressive Book, and that it is. I know a lot of book clubs are lining up to read this. There's so much to talk about in it, and we have a little parallel memory, and it's a delightful thing to read about The Wizard of Oz. So anyway, it's going to be a great book club book with lots to discuss in it. So will you all join me in welcoming Timothy Shaffert?
Thank you so much, Marty, and thanks all of you for coming out, and thanks to Tattered Cover for featuring the book. I thought I would read just a couple of excerpts from the book, and perhaps you'll have some questions that I can try to answer. But the book is set, as Marty said, in 1898 in Omaha. So turn of the century, Omaha was, the city was still relatively young, I guess, but it was kind of still known across the nation as a frontier outpost, essentially. And so with the success of the Chicago World's Fair in 1893, which perhaps you read about in Eric Larson's book, Devil in the White City, many cities across the nation felt inspired to try to replicate that success. And so Omaha was one of those cities, and they actually got it off the ground. They got federal funding. They got a lot of private business support. They actually sold shares and stocks in the fair. And so and they created their own white city, and with a lagoon down the center, a grand court, and then also a midway, much like Chicago's midway, with concessionaires that would move around from World's Fair to World's Fair. And so so the idea, as I said, was to convey to the rest of the world that that Omaha was a serious city with serious industries, politicians shaping national culture, and arts and entertainment influencing national perspectives, and to communicate that it was a sophisticated city. Now, the problem was that Omaha still was kind of a Wild West town. And so when the people got to town from all across the country, they discovered it was a city rife with crime, prostitution, saloon brawls, and all kinds of small businesses attempting to take advantage of the visitors. And so, and among these were the entertainers, the people that were central to the fair and central to the midway. And so there was the Grand Court with its literally temporary buildings. I mean, they were built with the purpose of tearing them down at the end of the summer. But they looked, for all purposes, like stone, like marble, and they looked sort of impenetrable. But even by July, the rotunda of one of the buildings had fallen into a fountain. And another building, the birds were picking the roof apart. And so there were all kinds of... So all summer long, the place was just kind of collapsing bit by bit. And so I was kind of fascinated by the people who were working the fair, and in some cases, the people who were taking advantage of the fairgoers. I mean, this was an age when you could be a famous pickpocket, for example. And so if you were a famous pickpocket, you came to Omaha for the fair to pick the pockets of all the people who are coming to town. One of my favorite stories was about a man, a visitor for the fair, who went to the barber, and the barber had all his prices marked, and he requested a mustache dye, which I guess is what you did at the turn of the century. So he got his mustache dye, and then they quoted him a price that was like triple the price on the list. And he's like, well, no, I don't want to pay that for my mustache dye. And they said, well, no, you will, or I'll slash your throat. And so he paid the exorbitant fee for the mustache dye and then went immediately to the Omaha police. And then there was an article in the newspaper about investigations, and then there were going to be all kinds of new policies applied to the barbers of the town because this was going on. This was prevalent, apparently, all across the city, the barbers taking advantage of the visitors. So the narrator of my book is a 25-year-old entertainer named Ferret Skerritt, who grew up kind of a child of the streets. He was an orphan, and kind of began to turn his life around with vaudeville, with entertainment. So he became a ventriloquist. He trained with a master ventriloquist, and the town's librarian was also the town's ventriloquist. And Ferret discovered a new way of life through reading and also through entertaining. And so he's a little skeptical about the fair, but he's looking forward to taking full advantage of the visitors. And he doesn't expect to fall in love, but he does. At the vaudeville house where he's performing backstage, he meets Cecily, who's on stage for one night. She's a kind of understudy for a morality play called Opium and Vanities. And she has no lines and no name in the play. She's known as the violet-eyed trollop. And so he helps her with her corset strings backstage, and in the way of love stories, he falls madly in love with her immediately. And so he eventually comes to learn that she's working the midway. And so that inspires him to invest himself more fully in the experience of the fair. And so this section kind of describes, or through Ferret's perspective, the White City when he first sees it. Up ahead, beneath the arch over the entrance, the ticket booth had opened, and the mob pulsed forth like a pack of twitchy rats toward a hole in a boat. The summer sunlight, harsh against the stark white arch, scorched us all, and those with umbrellas opened them, filling the air with the screech of steel spines and the pop of silk pulled taut. I skirted the fee by ducking in and out of the parasols of others, my accomplices barely noticing me at their sides, and we were nearly cheek to cheek, knocking elbows as I slipped around in their shade. I entered the courtyard, tucked in beneath some lady's ruffled white parasol, my head low to avoid suspicion. The lady took my arm, mistaking me for her gentleman, and she whispered in my ear with a lovely gasp, "Sugar." I patted her hand and somehow got away without her noticing that I wasn't hers. Once I was out from under the umbrellas and parasols, I looked up and saw what she meant. The buildings of the Grand Court shimmered with shattered glass that had been dusted over the whitewash to glisten like something from a confectioner's shop. And those buildings went on and on without end. I was most stunned by the expanse of it and all its elegance. The rotundas, the columns and pillars, the winding ivy, the rows of flags, the statues of winged horses, of chariots and bare-chested angels and warriors, everything white and shimmering as if chiseled from a salt lick. It was like looking upon an ancient city before it fell. It was not part of Omaha, but something in place of it, something else entirely. In this new place that had risen from the city's humid summer fog, the breezes seemed blown in from the sea. Most of the fairgoers floated slowly across the pavements as if addle-headed from liquor. They seemed to want nothing other than a lazy stroll through this strange, sudden kingdom that might just ripple away in the waves of heat. This was their spectacle, and they were determined to be marveled by it. I can't say I marveled for long beyond those first few moments. Soon enough, I felt the grit of Omaha's dirty wind between my teeth and in my eyes. The Grand Court was something I had to get past to get to the midway to find Cecily. And the court and all its white mansions looked like it might go on for miles, as if you could keep walking toward the end of it and never reach the other side. I'd known this lot when it was empty. Among my odd jobs over the years, I'd been a wharf rat, picking up work at the riverbanks, pulling in barges and loading up wagons. Me and the other boys had climbed to the top of the tall railroad bridge back before my fear of heights, allowing us to gaze across the fallow fields. I'd imagined the property mine. Even just a scrap of it, I'd dreamed. Even just a dry corner left for dead. A patch of land, I'd figured, would change everything. I'd get something to grow on it and live a halfway honest life. How had they fit this court into that stretch of empty fields? I'd never guessed it'd hold so much. And there, all down the middle of the court, was the lagoon, which itself seemed as long and wide as the river. The gondoliers steered their boats through the still water of the canal, and swimming among them was the one shaped like a swan. My friend Phoebe had told me about these gondolas and gondoliers sailing up the river in the winter, boats full of actors. I had pictured Cecily bundled in furs on a gondola's pillowed bench beneath a candy-striped awning, a kettle of hot tea on a tiny gas stove like some Russian duchess. And I'd pictured a swan gondola as elegant as the birds themselves. That wasn't quite the case. The swan boat, though pretty with its frail, curved neck, needed paint. The yellow was nearly all chipped off its beak, and the white of its wooden feathers was faded to the color of a dirty egg. There was hardly any blue left in its eyes. The bench of the bird's tail feathers had a heart-shaped back, like on a lover's swing, and even that looked battered, with faded velvet cushions. And yet I saw myself with Cecily sitting on that bench, sharing a bottle of wine. The boat's ruin had a shabby romance, like it had jumped the track of some cheap midway carousel sneaking into the court's precious waters. It was an honest wreck, and it was a welcome sight. After looking away from the swan, all I could see was the toil of illusion. I followed the promenade toward the bandshell, where speakers had already begun to speechify. I passed a patch of garden where a few women in aprons across their black skirts tended flowers, carrying what looked to be large bottles of perfume. They pinched at the bulbs of atomizers, enhancing the scents of the petals with floral extract. Nearby, a man wrestled with a tangle of wires and a lamppost. I could almost feel the electricity, as if it buzzed unharnessed in the air, singeing and bristling the hairs on the backs of my hands. I could taste sulfur on the tip of my tongue. This was the magic of the fair for me. The Grand Court had been built only to be torn down. It would never survive a single Nebraska winter. It all even seemed of the winter, like the mists that rose over the river in early December, those columns of steam and cloud that hover over the water like a ghost city. Cecily and I would fall in love at the fair, I determined. We would lose the whole summer as we stared at each other. And then we'd let this white city collapsed behind us. The place could turn to cloud and fade away like Avalon. So I'm going to skip ahead to when he actually does. He's met Cecily. He's sort of introduced himself, and he's invited her to go for a ride on the swan gondola. So he's arranged for a gondolier after the fair is closed to take them out for a moonlit ride. And so he's asked her to meet him, and he's now sitting in the swan gondola waiting for her, uncertain as to whether she'll show up at all. And I should mention that her job in the on the Midway is in the Chamber of Horrors, playing Marie Antoinette. So she's usually all dolled up in a big dress and makeup and powder and the wig, and she steps up to a guillotine, and she puts her neck in the guillotine. The lights go out, and they come back on, and the executioner holds out a bloodied wax head. And so Ferret's been going through the Chamber of Horrors over and over and over to watch Cecily be beheaded. And so as he's waiting for Cecily, he's reading a biography of Marie Antoinette, hoping that he can impress her with his new knowledge about the queen. And sure enough, Cecily shows up. Cecily came stepping down the staircase to the dock, her hair unpinned and combed out into its pretty, tangled mess of wild brown curls. Perfect, I thought. She's perfect. She's meant for me and only me. I slipped the book beneath the bench and stood to take her hand. Her skin, so freshly scrubbed of its powder and paint, looked too pink and sore, and I longed to give her cheek a very soft, sympathetic kiss. Cecily had brought along a young woman with hair an old woman's white. "Pearl's a dear friend of mine," Cecily said. "I think you'll like each other." And Pearl blushed with such a red fever that I worried about her. I wondered if I should ask if she was all right, or if that would only worsen her condition. I took Cecily's hand to help her into the gondola, and Cecily whispered to me, her breath on my neck, "Isn't Pearl so very cute? Everyone adores her." Her enthusiasm was a stab of disappointment. I helped Pearl into, and Alonzo, the gondolier, prepared the swan for sailing, standing next to the swan's curvy neck so he could row the craft toward the center of the lagoon. I took a seat up front, and Pearl and Cecily sat on the heart-shaped bench at the swan's tail feathers. In Cecily's lap was a thin stack of postcards tied together with twine. She unknotted the string, and she and Pearl read aloud from the unsent greetings. Cecily had become friendly with a postmistress, who had told her that many of the fairgoers who dropped souvenir postcards into the postbox failed to remember to address them. Cecily had been rescuing them from the postmistress's trash bin. "I hate to see them thrown away," she said. "Someone should read them, at least." Cecily took a pair of reading glasses from a little paper case marked with Chinese letters. The glasses, with hinges and springs, collapsed in on themselves, and she unfolded them, then set them on her nose. Somehow the old lady glasses made her look even younger. "My love," Cecily read aloud, "I typed this on a typewriter at the fair." She rolled her eyes and said, "That's all it says." She looked at me as if she knew I'd know better than to write a lover such empty words. I leaned back to listen. Cecily could render even the lazy, tossed-off greetings of strangers into something true and necessary. After she read a few more, she took off her glasses, and the three of us fell silent as we drifted on the water and watched the moon. Finally, Cecily sat up and seemed about to speak, but stopped. "I don't even know your name," she said. "Do you know mine?" "Yes," I said, "from when you played the violet-eyed trollop." "So maybe I know yours," she said. "Or I did, before I forgot it." "My friends call me Ferret," I said. Cecily covered her mouth with the postcard to laugh a little. "Why would your friends call you something like that?" she said. She then told Pearl, "Ferret's a ventriloquist. A ventriloquist without a dummy." "He's being repaired," I said. On the midway were two cottages side by side, each with gingerbread woodwork and scalloped shingles and picket fences. One was the toy shop with a doll hospital in the back where I'd left Oscar. The other, the incubator exhibit, where live babies were displayed. Both little cottages were meant to appeal to our sympathies. From the toy shop, we'd take home our own little darlings. And next door, the live babies, born too early, cooked in glass nests like new chickens. Nurses moved about like farmers' wives, peeking into the incubators, adjusting temperatures, eyeing the mercury of thermometers. For a dime, fairgoers could enter the exhibit to study the mechanics of the baby's little booths. They could cluck and coo at the unfinished infants resting in iron wombs. "Don't you want to know how Pearl and me know each other?" Cecily asked me. "I do," I said. "You do know how we know each other?" Cecily said with a wink. "No," I said, "I do want to know how you know each other." "Oh, well, Pearl's a shop girl and window dresser downtown," Cecily said. "And just before the fair, she sewed me into a mermaid's fin for an umbrella display. I tell you, it was scandalous, practically. I had hardly a stitch on." "Well, you tell him, Pearl." "Oh, well, yes," Pearl said, stuttering, blushing. "A mermaid. In the window. I'm the dresser." "Have you seen Pearl's windows at the department store?" Cecily asked. "At the Brandeis? Her windows have been in magazines. She studied window dressing in Paris." "Oh," I said. "She's a mad genius, Pearl is," Cecily said. "She does all the electricity herself. She can wire the whole setup for all sorts of tricks. She can make a mannequin vanish, then pop, there it is again, but with a brand new hat." She nudged at Pearl's hip with her own. "Well, you tell him, Pearl." I interrupted, leaning forward to offer the ladies each a cigarette, which they took without any ladylike hesitation. They let me light them, too. When I held the match between Cecily and me, and we both lit up, my face was so close to hers, it was like we were practicing for a kiss. I looked at her eyes as she looked down at the flame. The flame rose as we drew in our breaths. "What was the mermaid fin like?" I said. "Oh, you wouldn't believe it. It was so pretty, wasn't it, Pearl?" she said. Cecily dropped her hand with a sweeping gesture down the length of her legs, twisting her wrist back and forth like following a flowing wave. It stretched way past the ends of my legs like the train of a gown. "How'd you make it sparkle like crazy, Pearl? Tell them what it's made of." "Beads," Pearl said. "Satin." "She sewed on each individual fish scale," Cecily said, "and each individual bead." I nodded and smiled politely at Pearl. Cecily fanned herself with one of the unsent postcards. "Pearl isn't as quiet as she seems," Cecily said. "She introduced Susan B. Anthony a few weeks ago at a ladies' luncheon. Pearl is a dress reformist. She's very much against corsets, bless her heart. She says our corsets are making us feeble. We can't breathe." "The corset is an instrument of torture," Pearl said, her voice soft. "It doesn't fit the woman's natural figure." She shrugged her shoulders. "As long as a woman is trapped in her dress, she is disfranchised." Cecily had dressed simply, but I noticed the top buttons of her shirtwaist were undone, as were the buttons at her wrist, causing her sleeves to slip up and down her arms as she fanned herself. She wore boots of a damask silk, the laces up the side untied, allowing her to slip her stockingless foot in and out. Pearl, meanwhile, continually fussed with the pins in her hair, taking them out, putting them back in somewhere else. At one point, she even had a few pins between her teeth as she twisted a curl back to tuck behind her ear. I couldn't quite imagine this mousy girl leading any political battles. "Have you seen Cecily's Marie Antoinette act, Pearl?" I asked. "Yes," Pearl mumbled, the pins still at her lips. Cecily seemed to be waiting for Pearl to say more, and when she didn't, she said, "Pearl even did a window a few months ago with a mannequin dressed like Marie Antoinette. She gave her a hat that was swan-shaped like this here boat." Cecily wrapped her knuckles against the side of the gondola. The window had all these tall, towering cakes with pink and blue icing, not real cakes, but paper cakes that looked real, and the floor of the window was just cluttered with women's shoes. "It's much sadder," I said, reclining, my ankles crossed, my hands in my pockets, my cigarette hanging from my lip. "So much sadder how it all went in true life." "How what went?" Cecily said. "The offing of her head," I said, hoping Cecily would be impressed that I'd read up on the queen. "She'd been in prison, not the palace. All she did was iron her cap, actually. They cut her hair so it wouldn't get in the way of the blade, I guess. She had a plain nightdress of dimity, black stockings, prunella shoes with little heels. A poor actress gave her the dress," I added, nodding at Cecily with a wink. "Or so they say. And they say she stepped on the executioner's foot. She begged his pardon. Said she didn't do it on purpose. Those were her last words. I didn't do it on purpose. But in French, I guess." "Hmm," Cecily said, shrugging, flicking her cigarette into the lagoon. "What a terrible way to go." She kept her eyes on the water, and I worried I'd offended her by pointing out the inaccuracies of her horror show. But then I suspected she was just disappointed by the historical account. She preferred the queen going to the guillotine in a fancy dress and powdered wig. Alonzo returned to the dock, a little too soon, I thought. I helped pull the gondola up and assisted the ladies from the boat. Pearl blushed again, nodding her goodbyes. She stepped up the stairs as Cecily lingered with me a moment. She leaves work every night at 5, Cecily said, making her soft voice even softer, taking 3 cigarettes from the pack I held open. I hadn't noticed the little purse hanging from a chain at her side, attached to her belt. She clicked open its octopus-shaped clasp and dropped her cigarettes inside. "They have a sandwich counter right there at the store. Would it kill you to stop by there sometime and treat her to a cup of coffee, Ferret?" She sneered my name, but in a teasing way, a flirtation that made me blush like Pearl. You two can talk yourselves silly about Marie Antoinette's bedroom slippers. Cecily winked and left my side, and I sensed from the way she moved up the steps, drifting really, up toward the promenade that she knew I kept watching. She too was playing the part of a carefree summer lover, moving slowly, humming, looking up and around, pretending to not know any eyes were on her. But I loved that she knew I couldn't look away. And I'll stop there. So. Thank you so much. So, even though it's fiction, most everything's based on fact and based on details and research that I found. And so, certainly there are certain liberties that I took, but I tended to want to take those liberties after I found out exactly how things would have gone or how they would have gone about doing things. And, but there actually was an incubator exhibit at the Omaha World's Fair, as there were in other World's Fairs that traveled from event to event and eventually even ended up on Coney Island as a permanent exhibit. But it was one doctor's effort to actually kind of make the public familiar with this new invention, and it worked. You know, it eventually became they found their way into the hospitals. And so... And the detail about like the postcards, that was actually a detail from the fair that many people would fill out these souvenir postcards and throw them away put them in the post box without addressing them. And so the postmistress would end up having to throw them away. And so that was part of the reason the fair so captivated me, because there were all these little stories. You can read the actual Omaha Bee newspaper, which was one of the daily newspapers of the time, and you can see the actual pages on the Library of Congress website. And so you go there and you see an actual facsimile of the page, and on the front page there's always the official report of the fair, but then you go a little further back into page 5 or page 8, and that was where you would find the stories about the exorbitant fees for the mustache dye, or the entrepreneurs would set up kind of little shows just outside of the fair that would feature scantily clad ladies and the thievery and the saloon brawls and all the various kinds of thieves. Like one of the popular kinds of thief was sometimes a husband and wife team or man and woman team, where the woman would meet a gentleman, perhaps at a bar, invite him back to her place. And of course, there's another gentleman behind the door to jump out of the closet and steal his wallet and throw him out into the street. So that was what was going on in Omaha at the time. And so, the characters kind of evolved from all these various lives that I was reading into as I explored turn of the century Omaha, which was really turn of the century America, turn of the century West. You know, this was going on all over the place. So, 1898. So, and the Chicago Fair was in 1893, and then St. Louis's famous World's Fair was in 1904. And so Omaha's sort of fell in the middle between that and Chicago had the famous Ferris wheel, of course, as its centerpiece. Omaha had the giant seesaw. You remember that? You've all been on the giant seesaw. Which was just like it sounded like two compartments that would... And people got married on it or, you know, had parties and such. It wasn't an iconographic event in the way that the Chicago World's Fair was or the St. Louis event. This is what we call North Omaha now, which had been empty fields before that. And so the man who owned the property allowed the city to use it basically with intentions of turning it to real estate when they were done, because then streets would be paved, there'd be a new street line, electricity, plumbing, all of that. So it was designed to be temporary as a kind of effort to build the city more and to further its limits. So, but there's nothing that remains of it. The There's about two blocks of a city park called Kuntz Park in North Omaha that has never been built on, and there's a historical marker there. But otherwise, it's the fair only exists in photographs and the various remnants that you can find in private collections and museums and on eBay all the time. So that was part of the way I learned about more about 1890s in Omaha and across the country. Was you can learn a lot from eBay. Oh yeah, and I've tragically lost on some bids because I'm not a talented eBayer. But the great thing about eBay is that if it's photo based or document based, and they've just scanned it and put it up there for you to look at, you sort of own it just by making a copy and keep it in your files. So, I did come across a couple of things that actually found their way into the book too. So there was like a little, what I think I've discovered was actually they called it a scent bottle, but I think it had perhaps seeds in it, like maybe anisette seeds or something that, and when you had like a little wooden stick in it, when you twisted it, it would release a scent and you would wear it on your bracelet. And so, and it says, it was written across it. It says Omaha Exposition, 1898. So it seems such an incredible, and it's a shell. It's like an abalone shell. And so it just seems so fragile and such a delicate thing to have survived all those years, and such a romantic little thing. So it so Cecily ends up with that at some point, but and a handkerchief. So. Okay, the attendance numbers, I think what the official report was about 2.7 million. Now, I don't know exactly how those were calculated and how many of those were repeat attendees and that sort of thing. So, but just to compare, Chicago had 27 million. And so, the people who directed the fair, they were quite pleased with those numbers, and they claimed to have earned a profit. So since they all kind of bought into the fairs these as like stocks, the official report was that the fair turned a 95% profit. So, what was the other question? The automobile. There was Montgomery Ward had a horseless carriage that you could ride on and then order from their catalog if you chose to. But and which would have been the first time a lot of people from the area would have ridden in an automobile. So. Well, we don't have World's Fairs like that anymore. I mean, or they don't have the same, they don't play the same role. I mean, I think when we think of World's Fair, we really think of that turn of the century World's Fair where you would have seen so many new inventions and you would have experienced a horseless carriage for the first time and electricity and all these inventions, typewriters that would eventually, you would get a glimpse of what your life was going to be like in a couple of years. Now, there still is a World's Fair board, and they do still have World's Fairs like every 5 years. There hasn't been one in America since, I think the early 80s. I think there was one in Knoxville, Tennessee, and I believe that was the last official World's Fair that America hosted. So every 5 years? Every 5 years is how. So there really wasn't a governing board at this time, at the turn of the century. So I think that came into being around like maybe the 1920s or early 30s. And at that point, that fair board decided that there would be, the World's Fair, there would only be one every 5 years. And so even the World's Fair in New York in the 1960s, that was not an official World's Fair because it wasn't in the right sequence of events. So it's not quite like the Olympics, which has a very kind of a regimented process, that's right, absolutely. Oh yeah, there's all kinds of World's Fairs to exploit from that period. But the great thing about the turn of the century World's Fair is that, especially there towards the end of the 19th century, people really did feel like they were stepping from the past and into the future. I mean, the 20th century was the future, and it's and they turned out to be right, of course, because when you look at like 1925 versus 1898, what a world of difference. I mean, everything, you know, so much changed in terms of medicine and entertainment and fashion and women's rights. And one of the things my novel gets into are the patent medicines, which were so popular. And if you look at one of the great things about being able to see an actual facsimile of the Omaha Bee newspaper is that you don't just get the text, you also see the ads. And so you see how much these newspapers relied on these patent medicines as for their advertising revenue. And these medicines, at their worst, were completely harmless, or completely useless, completely worthless. You know, actually, at their best, they were that way. At their worst, they were fatal. So they, at their worst, they had alcohol, morphine, cocaine. I mean, people were giving their kids cocaine for toothaches, you know. And children were becoming morphine addicts before they were teenagers. And so so the FDA didn't exist yet, and that came about with the 20th century. So, and of course, entertainment changed. The movies came in, which changed the role of live entertainment in many people's lives.
Was there an attendance charge?
There was. And that was controversial, the attendance charge. It was, I believe, 50 cents to get in at the gate. And they would have specials to try to, and when the community complained that was too expensive, they dropped the price down for a little bit. And when not as many people were coming as they'd hoped would come, they blamed the admission fee. And then the Midway exhibits and rides, they all had additional tickets that you could have to pay like a dime for. So it could end up being a costly day out for some people.
How many days did it run?
It started June 1st, 1898, and ended, the last day was October 31st. So it went for 7 months. And the President McKinley came. He came at the end, towards the end of October. So we were also fighting a war that summer, the Spanish-American War. We'd kind of claimed victory by July 4th, basically. We were celebrating victory at that point. And so then the president was dealing with peace treaties and then came to Omaha for... right. So he came to Omaha for the Peace Jubilee to celebrate America's victory. And he was not assassinated at the Omaha Fair, but he would go on to be assassinated at the Buffalo, at the World's Fair in Buffalo, New York, a couple years later. So so maybe the Omaha World's Fair would have been more famous if if McKinley had been shot in Omaha. Oh yeah, the Wizard of Oz. So the novel actually begins with a balloon crash landing on a farmhouse. And I knew from the very beginning when I was thinking about this book that I wanted it to start with a balloon crashing. And that actually ended up being kind of detrimental because the longest time I knew nothing about balloons. And I was sort of overwhelmed by the fact that I was not only going to have to research how that would all play out, but also what 1898 was all about, which was an even more enormous challenge. Because I always feel like I knew even less than the average person knew about 1898. But did they have electricity? Did they drive around in cars? And so, as a kid, you know, I watched The Wizard of Oz. At that time, they played it on TV once a year. You know, which I remember as always being during tornado season, which I think is kind of perverse. But and I loved that moment when the wizard's in his balloon and it says State Fair, Omaha, across it. Now, as a kid, I was confused by that because the State Fair is actually in Lincoln. But I loved the idea of this iconographic literary figure coming from Omaha. So I read the book, and in the book, you get a little bit more about the wizard's origins in Omaha. And we learn that he was an apprentice to a master ventriloquist and an entertainer, and then it became a balloonist and got in the balloon and ended up in Oz. And so I kind of like the idea of exploring his Omaha experience, which seemed inevitable. You know, inevitably, he would find himself at the Omaha World's Fair. The World's Fair was in 1898, and Wizard of Oz was published in 1900. And so I liked playing with that idea, like thinking about, well, what would have driven Oz from from Omaha, and I thought, well, maybe heartbreak, you know, and I liked the idea of exploring who he would have fallen in love with. And also the idea that instead of landing in the land of Oz, that he would sort of build Oz from wherever he landed. And so that was what I was trying to explore too. It's like working in the same way that the World's Fair kind of was built up from nothingness, the idea of Ferret kind of doing that as well. But so I wasn't really thinking about it in terms of a literal sequel to The Wizard of Oz, or prequel, as we say, thanks to the movies. But that kind of plain, that novel serving as kind of a shadow and as a kind of influence as I followed the plot details of the characters and their lives. A kind of variation on a theme, I guess.
Is that all you knew about the Omaha World's Fair when you started? Was The Wizard of Oz?
What I knew about the World's Fair, I actually was invited to write a short story for a Christmas edition of the daily newspaper, the Omaha World Herald. And so I wanted to write a Victorian ghost story set at Christmas. And so then I thought, well, what should I do? And of course, the Omaha World's Fair was towards the end of the Victorian era. And so I liked the idea of exploring those characters and doing some research into that. And that's when I was really delved into the fair and its details. The characters evolve from that, and they show up in that story, but the story ends up being... I didn't really build too much off that original short story, but I knew I wanted to use those characters and to write a novel around it. So then that's when I really kind of started reading the newspaper. And I mean, I was reading the daily of the 1898 newspaper in the same way that people read today's newspaper in the morning. You know, I'd read what was happening that day. And I do actually have these bookmarks too. At the university, we developed an online archive, a digital archive of the expo, and which is hundreds of photographs, newspaper articles, documents, pamphlets, tickets, images, all kinds of things. And so, and that's transmississippi.unl.edu, which I have on the bookmark as well. That's transmississippi-unl.edu. It was originally called the Trans-Mississippi and International Exposition, referencing all the states west of the Mississippi were called the kind of the Trans-Mississippi region. It's more of a kind of Civil War era reference that doesn't really mean much to us anymore. And so I don't reference it as the Trans-Mississippi Exposition in the novel, partly because I feared people would think that Omaha was in Mississippi or along the Mississippi River, which is neither is the case. So, and it's plus it's sort of a mouthful, the Trans-Mississippi and International Exposition. So, but even that, the term the World's Fair wasn't one that was officially used for these events, and that was something that became kind of a colloquialism, I guess. And so the newspaper articles in the Omaha paper don't really refer to the Trans-Mississippi Exposition as the Omaha World's Fair. But if you look at postcards and look at notes that people took at the time, they were calling it the fair, and in some cases, the World's Fair. And so I think it was perhaps more popularly known as the Omaha World's Fair and less officially known. All right. Well, thank you all so much for coming.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.